And welcome to episode 17 of the Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching podcast. I'm your host, Derek Bruff, an assistant director here at the CFT. In this episode, we feature an interview with Gil Gualda, an assistant professor of earth and environmental science here at Vanderbilt. Last fall, Gil and his colleague Brendan Bream taught a very interesting course on the geology of United States national parks. As part of the course, Gil and Brendan and their students took a field trip to the Grand Canyon. Yes, that's right. They went to the Grand Canyon over fall break. And when they returned, Gil had his students put together a very interesting project in Google Earth as a way to share their trip. And so they documented their trip with photos and diagrams and descriptions, embedded those items, that content, in Google Earth at particular points along the trail that they followed. And then they made this content available to the public on a course website, so that anyone can use Google Earth, a program which you can download for free from Google, to essentially fly around the Grand Canyon in three dimensions and recreate their trip. Now, you may not be able to include a field trip to the Grand Canyon in the courses that you teach, but I think you'll enjoy hearing from Gil as he describes the ways in which this class project motivated his students. He gave his students some ownership over the project, and he promised to share the final product beyond the course itself with other faculty and students in the department, with students in future courses, and with the general public via the internet. And this motivated Gil's students to engage pretty seriously with the project and come up with a really good product. I think any instructors interested in incorporating student projects in their courses will find Gil's experiences useful. After my interview with Gil, you'll hear a few audio clips from his students' presentation of their project to the department at the end of the fall semester. First, here's Gil.
All right. Well, thanks, Gil, for speaking with me today. I want to talk to you about your course on the geology of natural parks that you co-taught with Brendan Bream in the fall. I'll start off by asking where you got the idea for this course.
Well, the idea for this course was actually Brendan's, and he had tried to offer it in the past as a main master course, which would be fundamentally a field course. And I guess where I come in is that I suggest maybe what we should do was to offer it as a regular semester course that had a significant field component to it, so that it'd be sort of a general geology through national parks kind of idea. And the notion there would be that we'd have class time to go through fundamentals and field time to actually go through the field experience for the students, which we think is really important. So that's kind of, it was this attempt to come up with something that could work and could draw enough interest to happen, but still have a significant field component to it.
And why natural parks?
I think the main reason to talk about national parks is because it is obviously a subject that attracts people naturally, and so it's sort of a draw to get people's attention to geology, and especially in this country, the national parks are really fantastic displays of some of very interesting geological features. So it's not exactly an excuse, but it's sort of like attention grabbing and sort of bringing people in to learn geology through national parks and see some pretty spectacular geology possibly in some of the national parks.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the people. Who are the students that took this course? Majors?
They're mostly non-majors, a couple minors. So one of the things that is unclear about this course, how we go about in the future, is that currently it has a 100 level number, and that actually turns out to be prevents quite a few people from taking it, because there's only so many 100 level classes that they can and need to take, and they feel compelled to take other classes that fulfill all their requirements of theirs. So basically what the audience, which was fine, was non-majors, potential minors, juniors and seniors. So it was a very people that either had taken one of our introductory geology classes or nothing at all. So it was a different audience than we expected and different from the usual class that this department tends to offer. So that was interesting in itself.
Mm-hmm. And what did you hope that the students would get out of the course by the end of it?
I guess my own perspective on this was that I really thought it was an opportunity to see geology through the national parks and basically be an unconventional basic geology class, and that we wouldn't go through the textbook sequence of basic geology, but we had the freedom to talk about all basic concepts, and we assumed very little knowledge beforehand, and we could put in a different perspective than it usually is done, not exactly in the sequence of disciplines and the discipline of geology, but rather as needed, so starting with, in our case, with plate tectonics and how different sub-disciplines interacted with plate tectonics, sort of the unifying theory of the Earth in a way, and then put national parks in that context, and so really use the national parks to give the groundings of geology, but from a different perspective, an unconventional maybe perspective, I think.
But because I think frequently instructors find it challenging when they have a lot of conceptual material to teach. Students like to have applications and something concrete that they can kind of relate to, and this offers that.
Yeah, and that was the national parks were that, because the national parks, one way or another, they tend to highlight one or another aspect of geology. And so I guess we, now that we've done it once, we have better ideas of how to do certain things, but we didn't have it that clear, I guess, at that point, but that was part of the goal, to then try to put the national parks in the context of, first, the geology of North America, then how the geology of North America reflects, in a way, plate tectonics and the history of plate tectonics, but it's very bold. Goal, and we were a lot more modest than that, but it was, I think the goal was to, the idea was, can they now appreciate geologic features and relate to some bigger processes in the Earth and have some grasp as to why they happen and how they relate to the Earth engine in a way, the plate tectonics engine, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk now a little bit about the structure of the course. There was a classroom component, but then field trips and a Google Earth project as well. So
that's right. So there were only 6 students, 2 instructors, so that was kind of high ratio, but that was good. The fact that we had few students meant that we could have a pretty informal, small classroom setting. We purposely, I think, avoided having a very structured structure, I guess.
Yeah.
And so we wanted for it to be kind of loosely constrained so that we could adapt to the course as it went, in part because it was the first time we were teaching, in part because we wanted the course to be like that, to be very student-driven rather than lecture instructor driven, so that was part of the approach. So what we did was basically divided the course into 3 or 4 parts, the first part being, let's build a little bit of a foundation, and in this case was a foundation on plate tectonics, sort of explaining why do things happen in the Earth the way they do, and they had some background in that, but variable, and so that was the first fourth of the course, maybe. Then there was a second part of the course, which was the geology of Western North America. Then the idea is that the third part would be the geology of Eastern North America. And finally, the fourth part would be more integrative and a project that they would develop, which, to be honest, when we started, we didn't have it very clear what exactly that would be. But we envisioned them thinking about a particular park or particular set of parks and writing some paper or some generating some product it would be very much their work, their understanding of the things we taught through the first three quarters of the course. So that was the basic structure. To go along with the second and third part, we had the field, that's where the field component went. And so the idea was to use fall break to do a trip to Western North America, and then in sometime in November, try to do a field trip somewhere around here, either to Rocky Mountain National Park, Great Smoky Mountains National Park, or Mammoth Cave. And it ended up being Mammoth Cave just because of the weather on the weekend we had decided to do. And so then the idea was to see Grand Canyon and the region around it in the context of the geology of Western North America and Great Smoky Mountains or Mammoth Cave in the context of the geology of what Eastern North America.
So let me get this straight. You took six students on a field trip to the Grand Canyon.
That's correct.
Over fall break.
That's correct. Okay. So we left very early on Saturday, came back very late on Tuesday, which gave us about 3.5 days in the field. 2 days in the Grand Canyon itself. On the day we went out, we went to see some volcanic rocks around the Grand Canyon. And on the way back, we stopped by Meteor Crater, which is also around in the area. So those were the 4 days in the field. And we were camping at the canyon for three nights, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So I have to ask the practical question. It's not cheap to go to the Grand Canyon.
Well, part of what we did was the students paid for their airfare. We were camping and eating it on site, so that wasn't very expensive. And a mixture of the department plus a venture grant that Brendan had gotten funded the rest of the trip. But basically, they were in charge of paying for their airfares, which was probably the biggest chunk of all the costs.
And they knew that when they signed up for the course, I guess?
That's correct. So before classes started, we sent an email to everybody enrolled saying, there's going to be this two or three field trips. The one to the Grand Canyon is mandatory. Out of the other two, we expect you to go in one of them, hopefully all of them, and explaining the cost situation. So we tried to be reasonably flexible, but at the same time, tell them that this was really a fundamental component of the class, so we really had to have them participate. Mm-hmm. And that worked out just fine, and they were very responsive to that, and very excited, obviously, to go to the canyon.
Yeah. I'm very jealous. I've always wanted to go. Never gotten a chance. So let's talk now a little bit about that final component of the course, the project. And it turned into a Google Earth project. Can you say how that came to be, and what did the project end up looking like?
So basically, Brendan and I had been sort of waiting for the right idea of what to do for the final fourth of the class. And one of the things we did is that we took GPSs to the field, just because that's now a practice that we have learned to exercise is to, whenever you're in the field, you carry a GPS, you record your locations. And we thought it'd be important for the students to do that too. And we figured we'd find a way to make use of that information later on. And it turned out to be quite great after all. So that was the idea of taking the GPS, was that we were going to do these geological expeditions and transects and investigations in the field, and that we'd record them on maps, on GPSs, and handbooks, notebooks, just like what we do in the field. While we're doing that in the field, we realize, now, differently from a few years ago, we have the perfect platform to display that kind of information, which is Google Earth, and it's freely available, and it's fairly accessible in terms of the technology and the learning curve, as it actually proved to be the case. So, basically, we decided that we were going to put the suggestion on the table that we wanted them to do a project documenting the trip and the observations that they made in the field using Google Earth as the platform for that. We really only laid out our general concept of what we wanted. We wanted them to accomplish something, and we were suggesting that they used Google Earth as the platform. We had all the GPS locations. They had all their notes, photographs, all sorts of different aspects of different kinds of documentation from the field observations. And we just wanted them to think about what is... So one part... And we set, and I think it was overall 4 milestones that they had to accomplish. And first milestone was come up with a concept of what they wanted to do. And our suggestion was sort of, well, here's a really powerful tool that you can use, but if you have something else, that's fine too. And obviously, they're smart enough and they picked up on that. If we're not, for no other reason, just to please.
Right. Yeah.
But I think it was important that they had a hand, and they really did, in the concept of what they wanted to develop. And then we set other milestones. The second milestone is that now you have a concept, now you have to have a proof of concept. So can you do, you're going to have all these points with all this information, can you generate 1 or 2 points that have more or less the information you'd like to come up? So it was like, can we transpose this technological barrier and come up with something? Because as we pointed out, once you do that, then it's a repetition of that to a large extent. And so we want to make sure that we can cross that barrier. So then the third milestone was showing a product that was nearly finished, or at least pretty far along. And then the fourth milestone was actually doing what Brendan would like to call the dress rehearsal. And in order to keep their motivation high, and it's really the right thing to do, I think, we really emphasized that whatever product that they generated, we were going to make that freely available to on the web, some in one form or another, such that it really was not an inconsequential product, that really was something, a product that people would have access to, that would also be accessible to students in future years, so that they could use that as sort of a reference as to what they could do. And that was an idea that came about in one of the workshops in the Center for Teaching, of using this, using previous year's experience as sort of a bar to be met and to be surpassed in a way. So they really felt motivated by that, that what they did was going to be accessible to anyone and was going to serve a purpose for the class itself in the future, that people would look at it with the eyes, look at what they've done, and this is really great. And they really didn't want to look badly as having had done a pretty crummy job on it. So I think that was a pretty good motivating factor. And the other thing that we did is that we wanted to have a presentation. We wanted them to, and that was one of the things that we had a little bit of trouble with. We insisted on this presentation, but we wanted to make it clear that the presentation was just a showcase of the product. The presentation was not the product. The idea was to generate some product that would be available and that would be sort of browse your way through this trip. And they were going to make a presentation just to showcase that and call people's attention. But again, that was a good incentive for them to do a good work, because they were going to have, we were going to invite people from the department, from outside the department, to come and see that presentation, as you did.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. So I think there were all these ways we tried to do to keep their motivation relatively high and keep them going strong for, it took more than a month for the whole thing to unfold. And we would dedicate at least about once a week we'd have at least half a lecture devoted to talking about these things and seeing where they were and kind of trying to keep them working. It was part of the challenge in a month-long project to make sure that they were actually working and not leaving it for the last day or last week or whatever.
Yeah. So they were sharing, they were creating a product in Google Earth that they would share with the whole world via the web,
mm-hmm.
right, with future Vanderbilt students,
mm-hmm.
right, who might make use of this. And more immediately through the presentation, a product that they were going to share with the local community that right. very semester.
Right.
So they had a lot of audiences, but it sounds like a lot of motivation to invest in it.
Well, and that was part of the goal about the multiple audiences was to keep them interested and motivated about it. And I think the stronger one was this thing we're going to put on the web and anyone will have access to it. So we wouldn't quite say this, but they really would hear that. It's like, I got to be careful because this is a permanent documentation of what we've done.
So. Right. As opposed to perhaps another model where they would create some product that you and Brendan would have seen as the instructors. You would have graded it. And that kind of would have been the end
and
of
that, it. And that's really what we didn't want to do. We didn't mm-hmm. want to be something that was made for us, and rather something that we would evaluate, but it wasn't made for us. It was made for some better and higher purpose.
Yeah. Now, we'll put a link to the Google Earth product on our
that's right.
podcast
so we,
page.
So but, part of my job was to actually... Well, we wanted them to do, but they didn't quite do it. So one of the things that I really felt pressed to was to make this content available on the web. So we created a web page mm-hmm. for the course that has a link to the KMZ file. Now we're talking a little bit of
it. Yeah. Say a little bit more. Just I know it's hard to describe Google Earth verbally, but if you can try to describe kind of what it was the students constructed.
So what the students constructed was a series of points in space where they could attach all sorts of information. So if you want to think about it, you can think about the representation is a pin, push pin, right? At a given particular location. And that point can have all sorts of information attached to it. The way they ended up doing it, and that's probably the better way to do it anyways, is there is a mini web page attached to every one of these points. And the web page can have photos, can have text, can have links to other web pages. So basically what it is a bunch of push pins that you can click. There's a little pops, a little window that has some text, some photos relative to that point. Not only that, but at every location you can store not only information about that location, but you can also preserve some particular orientation that you want. So one of the things that's really cool is as you click your way through it, you fly from one point to the other and you land on the position that the student decided was the right way he or she wanted you to see it. And there are comparisons of there is a particular photo in the same orientation that you're looking at the landscape in Google Earth, so you can see the overall landscape and see details in the photo. So,
because Google Earth is kind of like Google Maps in that you can navigate around, but it's 3D.
It has all of the topography information, yeah. So you can navigate through it not only in latitude, longitude, but also in your position relative to it. And so you can, and what we think is really fantastic about it is that while there is this flyby from one point to the other like the student envisioned it, there's also, you have the freedom to then go and move around and look around in different perspectives. So it's very much like navigating on a web page, but rather you're navigating in space with information attached to that space. And where we come in is that we create the information that wouldn't be there.
So you can kind of recreate the path that your students took as they were exploring the Grand Canyon.
That's right. So the way they decided the photos, to do it, and that was really their decision, is that they wanted to organize it, at least the sequence in which it appears in Google Earth is the sequence that we took. So it goes first day, second day, third day, fourth day. And they are displayed actually in different colors so you can tell what was done in what day. And in the, if you look at the menu on the left-hand side where you can navigate through it, they are organized by day and bunches of points per day. So that was their decision on how to do it, and they thought that that was a good way of showing it, and it really showed the trip really well. But I think what's really attractive about the platform is that you're not bound by that. It's like the example is when we started thinking about web pages back, not that far back, one of the difficulties that people had was the notion that you could jump from one page to any page in the document, and you didn't have to go sequentially through the document like in a book. And so it's the same kind of concept. It's like, imagine a PowerPoint presentation of a trip. You're bound by the sequence that someone has envisioned. In this case, you're not, because you can jump to any point, from any point to any point at your will. And you can make, you can, and you're looking at a spatially referenced platform, so you can see that certain point is close in space to another point, and maybe you'd rather go there rather than the way we went. And so that's the freedom that I think Google Earth gives you that we really don't have otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Well, would you have any advice for other instructors who may not be going to the Grand Canyon, mm-hmm. and they may not even be using Google Earth, but this idea of having a pretty significant project at the end of a course, that's not uncommon, actually. Mm-hmm. So would you have any advice for instructors who are looking to implement something like that, that's a project that summarizes a course in a single way?
I really think that part of the reason, I think one of the main reasons why they really kept themselves motivated and they really got into it is that they thought they had a hand on it. It was really their doing and not something, some task we had created for them. It was really their project. And so I think, even though obviously the concept eventually was very much molded by our own perspectives, but Brandon and me, I mean, it still was their decision to adopt whichever the advice we gave or not, or which things to take in and which things to leave out. So I think they had a sense of ownership that was really important, and they really felt the importance of. I think the other aspect is this thing of being available and not being something that was constrained and limited to the class, that really went well beyond that. I think they really felt pressed. I mean, they would say that they felt pressed by that responsibility of having that available not only to us. So it wasn't enclosed by the walls in here. It was really, so I think those two aspects were really fundamental. And the other aspect was that we wanted this to be a big deal, and we made a big deal out of it. We would spend big chunks of lecture time to discuss and talk, and at times we felt like, geez, we're sort of wasting time, or not, maybe this is not the best use of our time, and at times those discussions were not very fruitful. But by and large, I think that it was, I think that was part of us showing them, this is really important, we really want you to take the time to do this. And so I think that maybe those are the three aspects that I think is them having a sense of ownership, having a sense of responsibility, because that went well beyond the classroom. And finally, it's us showing them that this was really important part of the class by taking the time and being interested. And everything else just followed through. And one of the things we were really uncertain about was the technological aspect of it. And that wasn't a problem at all. We really just said, you know, good luck, and come back if it's too bad. And they never did. I mean, obviously some got more involved than others, some knew better than the others, but the other thing is that it was this unified product, and so if you go see the product, you're going to realize that some of the students got better at it than others, so some are somewhat better than others. But they really felt pressed by that because they knew that once they understood the platform, they realized that what they did was going to be next to what everybody else did. And they didn't want to lag too far behind. They were okay lagging a little bit behind, but they didn't want to lag too much. So I think that was another positive aspect.
Great. Well, thanks, Gil.
No problem.
Appreciate you taking this time.
My pleasure.
And now here are three of Gil's students sharing their Google Earth project at a presentation in the fall.
So the first part of our trip is focused around what's called the San Francisco Volcanic Mountain Area. And one of the places we went was called Sunset Crater. And it's a cinder cone in that area. I'm going to show you kind of a view of what it looks like there. What we're zooming in on is the crater itself. And this is kind of the first view we had of it, with actual pictures that we took to kind of complement this. And I guess this part of the presentation I wanted to cover what caused the cinder cones in the area. There's over 600 volcanoes in the San Francisco volcanic area itself. Most of them are basaltic cinder cones. Some of them are different types of lava, but the majority of them are basaltic cinders, which are caused by, this one in particular was about 960 years ago, I guess, with the last eruption, where a big fault went down into a magma chamber underground into a really kind of low viscosity basaltic magma that erupted out, and about 3/4 of the magma that came out was erupted as cinders, which flew up in these really drippy kind of globs of lava that cooled in the air and then fell in a pile. And any kind of pile of particles like that will have a certain angle at which, when the stack becomes too steep, the walls will collapse until it creates a certain angle, and that angle is called the angle of repose. And for cinders, it's 35 degrees. So all cinder cones, all types of cones that you see that are made of cinders, all have the same basic shape, the 35 degree slope.
I kind of want to touch on the importance of our GPS units that we had. That's the reason we're able to do this satellite Earth. Realize that each point that we're talking about, the reason we're able to match up actually these photos so perfectly with what's on Google Earth, is because we're carrying around GPS receivers and marking each point, so we have all the data. We have the latitude, longitude, and our altitude. So to be able to come back from this trip and actually completely recreate it, not just by looking at a map, but knowing the exact point that we were standing on at the moment, was definitely a cool feeling. And then the fact that Google makes such detailed maps available, it allowed us to do this presentation. But we woke up early on Sunday morning, and we started hiking out to the canyon. And our first time to see the canyon was at Grandeur Point. And from talking about it for a full month and reading about it and talking about the science, it suddenly kind of did not become purely a scientific thing, but almost, it was such a beautiful sight. It almost became a spiritual thing. We first, walked over that ledge from just kind of dry, dusty, sparse landscape, and then look down into this. For me, someone who had never experienced kind of the West like this or seen the Grand Canyon, the pictures really didn't do it justice until we saw it for the first time.
So these are just more shots of us walking along the canyon. That's one of the actual ones that we drew, and that's the one that he overlaid for you. So like you said, we did get a pretty good... mine wasn't so pretty, but others did a very good job at actually eyeing it, using their eyes to draw a pretty accurate topo map. So that's a close-up of squirrel action. So as you can see, this top layer here that you're looking at, do I have a cursor here? There you go, is the Kaibab Formation. This is a better shot of what the actual layers. So you can see, I mean, just as like a casual observer, you can see that the rock types are very, very different. So as we headed down the trail here, this is kind of a better shot. You can see right there where the trail is going. And so we kind of had to make our way down through this area and walk around. And they, the way they constructed the trail was they used basically TNT to blast away parts of the walls where they could find, like, just make ledges and kind of just make switchbacks all the way down. So from the very top, you could see we had to walk like a pretty long way just to get to the first switchback. And it can take you, it took us, what, 4 hours to go 1,700 meters down. So it takes a really long time to get depth because you have to walk along the trail back and forth. So along these days, we had a few trips and falls, a couple near-death experiences with Jessica. But we arrived safely to the first switchback. So here, the first switchback, and what you're going to hear us talk about a lot is transitional points. So where one layer turns into the other and what was going on between the two layers, that you have one sediment deposited and then a new sediment deposited on top of it. So as this at this first switchback, what you're seeing, you're looking at this transition right here. So the difference between the Kaibab and the Torweep Formation, as Ross talked about, the Kaibab was deposited...
That was Gil Gualda, Assistant Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences, and a few of his students describing the Google Earth tour of the Grand Canyon his students created last fall. I'd like to thank Gil for taking the time to speak with me, and to thank his students for sharing such an interesting project. In the show notes for this podcast, you'll find a few interesting links. One is a link to the Geology of Natural Parks course website that Gil put together. There you can download the Google Earth content that Gil's students created. You'll also find a link to Gil's homepage. Now, for those wondering if Google Earth might only be useful to those in the earth sciences, you'll also find a link to a website called Google Lit Trips, where teachers have mapped in Google Earth the travels of characters in works of literature. So it's an interesting kind of humanities use of Google Earth. And for those interested in creating nonlinear presentations without using Google Earth, you'll find a link to a service called Prezi, which allows one to create nonlinear zooming presentations, a very interesting alternative to programs like PowerPoint and Keynote. You'll have to go and check it out to kind of see what I mean by a nonlinear zooming presentation. But it's an interesting approach to sharing information. So that's it for episode 17. If you have any questions or comments about this episode, please visit our blog located at blogs.vanderbilt.cft. podcast and let us know your thoughts. Vanderbilt instructors interested in discussing any aspect of their teaching are invited to call the CFT at 322-7290 to arrange a meeting with the CFT teaching consultant. We're glad to help you reflect on and explore the various choices you make as a teacher and to connect you with resources you'll find useful as you design, implement, and assess learning experiences for your students. I've been your host, Derek Brough. Thanks for listening.